Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. Join us on tonight's episode when my guest Michael reminisces about moving to Hollywood to pursue his dreams.
And someone got murdered in our driveway the first 2 weeks we were here.
The topic is Golden Girls, Designing Women, and Improv Comedy. How do you muster the nerve to keep going when it seems like the odds are stacked against you? My guest this week picked up some life advice from Improv Comedy, in particular, the lesson to say yes and then heighten whatever's happened so far. Though you may know Michael Henry from his YouTube comedy videos, his acting background is far more serious, and he expected to become a serious dramatic actor. The fact that he could only seem to make audiences laugh troubled him for years, until he realized he could say yes to comedy and the unexpected direction that would take him. We'll have that conversation in just a minute, but first, I want to invite you to a week-long live stream of games starting Sunday, October 28th. It's the return of Extra Life, an annual fundraiser for Seattle Children's Hospital. We're kicking the week off with a big gay game of Dungeons & Dragons featuring comedian Brian Safi, culture critic Carlos Maza, writer Anthony Oliveira, and scholar Brian Wiest. Then I'll be streaming games every day from October 29th to November 3rd, and on Sunday, November 4th, join us for another game of D&D featuring the drag queen cast of Queens of Adventure in full drag. We'll be serving looks, interacting with viewers, and encouraging everyone to donate to Seattle Children's Hospital. 100% of everything you give goes straight to the hospital. Get the details and watch us live at bit.ly/extralifeseattle, and we'll see you starting October 28th. By the way, I hope you'll join us for the next Sewers of Paris live chat with special guest Seattle drag superstar Arson Nikki. It's Saturday, October 27th at 2 p.m. Pacific. There's a link at the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Huge thanks to everyone who makes the Sewers of Paris possible with a pledge of $1 or more a month on Patreon. There's rewards for folks who back the show. Just click support the show on Patreon over at sewersofparis.com. Or you can support the Sewers of Paris for free by leaving a review on your podcast platform of choice. That really helps folks find the show. Head over to sewersofparis.com to see clips of the stuff we talk about on each episode. And for more queer podcasting, check out Queens of Adventure to hear drag queens on an epic Dungeons & Dragons quest. That's at queensofadventure.com. Now, here's Michael. Well, I'm speaking this week with superstar Michael Henry. Thanks so much for joining me.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Oh, television. I mean, I grew up watching television. I think I was raised on television. Both my parents worked pretty much the entire time that I was being raised. So I spent a lot of time with my grandparents who lived in the same house as us. And we just watched television, like Dr. Quinn, The Golden Girls, Designing Women, Westerns. I just fell in love with television and thought everything about it was so fascinating. And I just saw how entertained everybody was by it. And I just always wanted to be a part of that.
What was in your media diet?
The Golden Girls was like a mainstay. I loved that show, Designing Women, Will and Grace, all comedies for the most part. Dr. Quinn was a major part of our lexicon, though, as well.
So we should probably talk about like Golden Girls and Designing Women, because those two shows seem to be in like a very similar family. But
yeah.
Like, how old were you when you were watching them? You must have been kind of young, right?
I was watching these on repeat. I wasn't watching them on prime time. So just want to make that clear for everybody that I'm not that old, which mm-hmm. is fine to be old, but I'm not that old. But I was watching them when I was like 10, 11, 12, 13, all throughout high school.
What does, looking back, I mean, it seems obvious that, of course, all gay men love these shows for reasons that we can go into. As like a junior high school kid, mm-hmm. did you feel like, what did you have in common with these characters? Like, why did they resonate with you?
They all kind of felt like they were in the margins. They all kind of felt like they were had something to prove. They didn't come right out the gate as people that people respected, like these characters I'm talking about. Like in Designing Women, they were interior designers and everything, and they always had something to prove. And on The Golden Girls, like Dorothy, everybody always made fun of her appearance. Rose, they made fun of her brains. Blanche, they made fun of her for being kind of like a tramp. But they all defended themselves with humor and in such a smart way. And I always thought humor was such an important way that you could get your power.
Did you feel like
they did?
Were you on the margins as a kid?
Oh, I wasn't even in the book. I was nowhere in high school. Even up until I was about 19 or 20, I felt like I didn't belong anywhere. Mm-hmm. I had some friends here and there, but I didn't feel like I knew where I belonged. I knew that everybody, I was bullied a lot for being gay and for being feminine, and I knew that parts of me were wrong according to other people. So I felt like I always had to defend myself.
Where were you growing up?
I grew up on Long Island, New York.
So, I mean, like, you have some proximity to Manhattan and New York and, like, a world where people can be weird and exciting and strange, but mm-hmm. It sounds like, was it just, like, just a little too far away for you to take advantage of that?
No, it was very close. I just felt so disabled, and I just felt so disempowered, and I felt like I just felt scared to even express myself like that.
What did you want to express?
I just would have loved to have been able to, I just wore sweatsuits, and I just did not even visually express myself in any sort of way other than bland. I wanted to be more than bland, and I just didn't feel comfortable trying because I was afraid of having other people tell me that I was doing that wrong too. So I just didn't feel like New York City was that accessible for me because I was afraid of any type of judgment that would have came out of it. But then once I did go to university, I went to college on Long Island too, but I found a group of friends and we went out into the city a lot, and I did kind of find my way a little bit more, but I didn't really find my way until I moved to Los Angeles when I was 22.
What did you go to college for?
I went to college for acting, but we did a lot of classical theater and studied a lot of Japanese theater, like that style of training. It was a very avant-garde liberal arts school.
And yeah. So, like, what did Long Island University have to say about, like, classical Japanese theater?
Well, it was a training style, and this style was, like, the person that created it, his name is Tadashi Suzuki, and it was all very, like, movement-based style of acting. So it was just a very, like, pushing yourself physically in a very slow, concentrated way. And it was a way to, like, push your body so your brain kind of wasn't getting in the way of it all.
So
you were just, yeah.
Like, when you say pushing, like, do you mean, like, physically? Or
yes,
like,
yes.
What are you actually doing?
Some of the things were, you're just walking with intention extremely slowly towards something, but with a lot of resistance in your body. Something that's huge with that is called stomping. It's literally that you're stomping into the ground for about 20 minutes. You're almost like breaking your body so that your brain can just function on its natural basic necessity level. And that's where you should operate from.
What's
from
the connection
standpoint
between just like stomping? Like, how does that prepare you to act?
I mean, it's definitely an extremely artistic and not very practical way of approaching acting on a job type of situation. But in a theater and avant-garde emotional standpoint, it's just exhausting your body in a way so that your brain doesn't get in the way. You know, you're not overthinking things. You're not overanalyzing things as an actor. You're just a human that's participating in natural responses with other people.
Did your brain often get in the way?
You know, when I was doing it correctly, it didn't. But it is very, it was difficult to get into that place. I'm happy that I did this for the few years I did at university. But all I've ever wanted was to be a working actor and in TV and films. So kind of after school, I just let it all go with no regrets.
What did you let go? Were you too much in your head?
I mean, it's natural to be in your head. Everybody's an overthink. Everybody thinks a lot, you know. That's something about college acting and that whole artistic training, you just have to morph it into what's practical for you as an actor or a performer when you are trying to get jobs. Like, that whole training did not prepare you to get jobs, and they were clear about that. Like, you need, there's a more tactical standpoint to go about things, and that's what I wanted to do more of.
Did you get to actually perform in any shows in that environment, or was it just like
yeah
oh no, okay so what kind of shows yeah. did you do
oh what the heck did I do I did The Tempest, like Shakespeare. I did The Balcony, which is like a classical theater show. I did A Dollhouse, which is Ibsen. I did a bunch of like things that only like theater nerds would kind of know.
This sounds like it's a million miles away from the sitcoms that influenced you growing up.
It is, because in college I was like, you know what, I want to be an artist. I want to be an artist. You know, I never felt like an artist before. And I'm glad that I had that section of my life to feel that way, in that kind of she type of art, selfish sort of way. But I'm happy that I'm completely back in the realm of what influenced me when I was younger, which is comedy. And that's an art form in and of itself that I had to kind of learn.
You said you wanted to be an artist for a while when you were in college. What did an artist look like to you? Like, what did you want to create as an artist?
Emotions. I wanted people to take me seriously. I've always been a very funny, humorous person.
Mm-hmm.
And even when I was in college doing classical theater, I was doing Ibsen. People were not taking me seriously. So that was extremely frustrating, because during that period, all I ever wanted was for people to like take me seriously. But it was clear that section of the arts was not my calling.
Why weren't people taking you seriously?
I don't know. I just have a very I have a very funny way of moving my body. I think my voice and my cadence is kind of humorous to people, just the way I naturally am. People don't seem to take too seriously, which has its positives and its negatives. It just lends itself more to comedy, which I'm completely satisfied with, because I love comedy. But I do feel shades of wanting to still be taken seriously in certain projects.
When we were talking about why you like Golden Girls and designing women and those kinds of characters, you said it was because they had something that they had to prove to people. They had to prove that they belong there. And it sounds like that's exactly what you were going through in college.
Oh, 100%. For sure. I've even today, I always feel like I have something to prove. So that's why I feel like I relate to female driven shows. I think a lot of gay men, but I'll speak for myself, I relate more towards female narrative shows, because they always feel like they've got something to prove, because people are never taking them seriously within the narrative of the show that they're in. So I just felt like I had something to prove at that point.
Well, there was just an article, and when we're recording this, like a day or two ago, it was an article by Linda Bludgeworth Thomas, I think, the creator of Designing Women. She just wrote an article for Hollywood Reporter about her experience with Les Moonves, who's the sexual predator who's running CBS for like decades. And so she talks about her experience about not being taken seriously by him because she was a powerful, outspoken woman, and about how he would assault and abuse women in his presence. And so, like, not only the characters on the shows that we were watching, but I mean, even the actors and creatives behind those shows, you know, we're hearing now in this age that just how much they had to endure as people who weren't taken seriously by these terrible people who were running the show.
I know. I mean, I could believe it. I mean, that's real. That's unfortunately real life. In that, unfortunately, that's what a lot of women go through, and a lot of gay men, I feel like, go through that too. I feel like I've always had to prove myself to other men that I belong in a situation. I have a very effeminate way about me, and people always think that's a bit of a joke.
So did you ever feel like when you were at that initial point at the school where you're doing some very, I guess, experimental training? Did you ever have a feeling like, okay, people think I'm funny, I guess I should lean into that, or did you resist that?
Oh, I resisted it for sure. I resisted it, and I got very depressed about it, because I felt like I wasn't going to be able to get to do something that I really wanted to do. I just felt like my body, I just couldn't train my voice and my body and the way I am to do that. And it was very depressing. But then I came to the realization that, you know, maybe this isn't 100% what I'm supposed to be doing. Maybe I have a funny voice, or humorous way that I move my body or whatever. Maybe I have these things for a different reason, and it's for just a different avenue in performing and artistic expression.
Was there something that prompted you to make that realization, or at least come to terms with it?
Therapy.
Yeah, well, that'll help.
Years and years of therapy has helped guide me in my decision making.
I mean, that does sound like a nice place to be able to land it. I mean, easier said than done, but to be like, oh, I have assets, I have something to offer, and maybe it wasn't the thing that I thought I had, but I still got it. And if you got
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
So what came next after going to sort of like artist school? Then
after that I moved straight to LA. Yeah, right. Like just like 2 months after I graduated from college, I was like, forget this. You know, I'm not going to do the New York thing. It's all about experience. It's all about theater. It's all about, you know, taking yourself seriously as a artist and all that stuff. And that's completely fine. But I felt very deflated and defeated in that category. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to move to Los Angeles. I've always wanted to live in LA anyway. So I just beelined it over here with a friend. And that was the next stage that I completely found myself here. So this was like almost my college.
Had you ever been to Los Angeles before that?
You know, I flew to LA the summer after college just to like see if I even liked the vibe here. Mm-hmm. So for a weekend, I flew out here by myself. I didn't have a smartphone. I borrowed my friend's TomTom GPS. Mm-hmm. I rented a Ford Taurus. I was like, oh my God, I am an adult on my own this weekend across the nation. I've never done something like this by myself before. Can I even think about moving here by myself? And I just did.
I appreciate that. It felt like you were roughing it with like a borrowed TomTom. I will say that I moved to Los Angeles with a Thomas guide. And we had to flip through a physical piece of paper while we're driving.
My gosh.
Yeah. So at least
you win.
Yeah.
You needed the North Star to get here.
Yeah. Oh my God. It was a different, like living in Los Angeles now versus prior to any sort of navigational equipment. It transforms the city to actually have someone telling you where to go versus, yeah, just point yourself in a general direction and eventually you'll find something like,
right. No.
So you moved out there, you had like a little, experimental time of your own to be like, is this something that fits with me? What was what told you like, okay, yes, this is right.
I just fell in love with what everybody does, what you think you know about LA. I came here and I was like, the Hollywood sign, the weather, the beautiful people, everything about it just was like, I can see myself being a part of this place. So, you know, I was like, and I had to go somewhere. I had to go either to New York City or to LA. And honestly, I just always wanted to be here. And whether I liked it or not during that weekend, I probably still would have came.
You weren't going to go back to Long Island?
No.
What was the plan when you moved to LA? Like, what were you expecting?
I was expecting to be on a TV show within a year. That was what I wanted. I was like, you know what? I'm going to prove to everybody in college that didn't think that I was serious or didn't think that I belonged in any area of the acting field. I'm going to prove to them that they're wrong. But that didn't happen, and I'm happy it didn't happen. You know, I needed to, you know, gather my bearings and realize that, you know, LA is a trek. It's a trudge. You have to get, there's a lot of things you have to get through here. But that was my ideal scenario.
Did you have a particular kind of show or a particular kind of role that you wanted to do?
I just wanted to be on a show that everybody was watching. I don't even remember what was on in 2009 anymore. Probably still The Big Bang Theory.
So you like come with your experimental theater training, you come stomping into Los Angeles. What was the reality of it? Like what was your first year in LA?
You know, honestly, I was planning on coming here by myself, but a friend of mine I was like, you know, I'm going to move to LA. She's like, you know what? I'll move too. I was like, oh, okay, sweet. So I came here with, at the time, who was a good friend, but, you know, we didn't go to college together or anything. We didn't really know each other 100% well. We knew each other well, but we not to the point where we were going to move across the country and live together. But we did. We became very best friends, and we're still good friends. But we came out here and got a place together. The first place we moved to was in East L.A., and someone got murdered in our driveway the first 2 weeks we were here.
Oh, my God. How did that happen?
They said it was gang activity. We were like, oh, this is L.A.
Wow.
Yes. So we ended up getting a different apartment in West Hollywood.
Probably for the best.
It was very, I mean, you know, it worked out for the two of us. It was an amazing year and a half. Some people, they first come here, it takes them a while to get adjusted. You know, the first year and a half here was just like fun, partying, having a good time, you know, going on auditions. I definitely enjoyed it very much. After a year and a half is when the dust started to settle, and I was like, oh, okay, you know, I have to like buckle down. And my friend ended up moving out and moving in with her girlfriend, and I kind of felt like that at the year and a half mark is when I felt the cracks in the situation here.
What did those cracks look like? Like, what were you feeling, or what were you perceiving?
Well, I was like, I had never lived on my own before. Before I lived out in LA, I had always lived in my parents' house. So I moved out here, and it was my first time like living with another person and navigating that. And that person wanted to move out, move in with her girlfriend. And then I had another random person move in, and that person ended up being a total nightmare. He had his boyfriend move in after a month, who was a ex-con alcoholic, and they didn't pay rent. And I was like, I don't know what to do. I ended up having a total meltdown panic attack, and I had to go to the hospital. I felt, looking back at myself now, like that was like, what, eight years ago. I was like, oh my God, you poor baby. You just were panicking. You didn't know how, you'd never had experiences like this before. You didn't have enough adulthood. You didn't have enough tools to be like, forget everything. Forget all of this. I don't need you. Who cares? Okay, you're not paying. I'm moving out too. Forget this. You know, I didn't feel like I had the power to make decisions. I felt like, you know, I expected everybody to be nice and treat me well and treat me with respect. And I didn't know how to navigate people not doing that. Not saying my friends didn't treat me that way, but having to, you know, concede to things that she wanted, which was move out, and, you know, our friendship kind of maneuvering back and forth, and me trying to, at that point, maneuver LA and things on my own was difficult and challenging. But, you know, and it took me honestly like 3 or 4 years to get to a place, back into a place where I felt settled in a groove.
Yeah, it sounds like that was a real difficult time, especially like you said you had to go to the hospital because you just couldn't handle it.
I didn't know I was having a panic attack. I just knew that I was panicking and like crying and, you know, all the symptoms of having one. And I was with a different friend at the time, and we went to the hospital, and they were like, you're just panicking, you know.
That's all,
you know. They gave me an EKG and everything in case I was having a heart attack, but I wasn't. It was just one of those things. It's like, before unless you've had situations like that, you don't know how to navigate that. I didn't know how to feel like, you know, a strong totem pole like I do now.
What do you do with that information when someone's, you know, a healthcare provider's like, oh, you're just having a panic attack, goodbye. Like, then what?
Then I went home to the apartment that I hated living at because I hated those roommates. And I was like, I just didn't know what to do other than like try to calm myself down. And I was like, you know, things are going to go in a better direction soon. I definitely had that feeling. I always, you know, even to this day, I've always known things are going to go my way at the end of the day. So I knew that things were going to end up going my way. And eventually they did. I moved out and I got a different I moved into a different place of my own with a different person, and after that it was kind of, you know, smooth sailing. Yeah.
So how did that happen? Like, how did you find the right person to move in with and kind of pick up the pieces?
It was a coworker mm-hmm. at a restaurant that I was working at. And, you know, she was having her own thing. And I was like, I need a place. You need a place. Do you want to just, like, get a place together? So we weren't really friends, but we just both needed a place. And neither of us had any money. So we shared a one-bedroom together, also in West Hollywood, which at the time was $1,100. And, you know, we just kind of had each other's back. We were both, like, kind of going through something, and it was a perfect situation for what it was. And actually, at that point, I got a scholarship to go to one of the comedy schools out here in L.A. So that's when I started blossoming into doing comedy stuff. So it was that's when I was getting on a better track.
So to get that scholarship, obviously, you had to, you know about it and apply for it. Mm-hmm. Was that something, like, that you resisted doing? Were you like, oh, I don't want to apply for that because it's comedy?
Yes. A different friend that I had worked with went to this school. It was called IOS. It's not really a thing anymore here. But she went there and she loved it. I was like, that's clown school. I'm not going to go to be a clown. I'm an actor, you know. But at the time, I was like, I'm doing student films, okay? I'm not doing this comedy nonsense. Improv? What the heck? No.
Yeah, respectable stuff like student films.
Exactly. But I was like, forget you, I'm not doing this. And she was like, okay, forget you too. And then eventually I went to go see a show of hers. And I was like, oh, this looks like fun. So I just applied for this scholarship. And I got it. And I started taking classes there. And I'm glad I started there because it was really just kind of an intro into this comedy world. And I definitely felt in love with it. I hadn't been performing since I went to college, which had been like 2 or 3 years previous to this, and I was like, you know what, I'm getting my theater fix again. I'm feeling a combination of feeling like that artist that I wanted to be in college and that comedian that with the arsenal of humor like they have in the sitcoms. I felt like it was a perfect marriage.
So what kind of shows were you doing? Like, was it just like workshops, or were you actually performing?
It was all improv. If anybody's ever seen, like, improv, they have this form called Harold, which is, they're, like, 20, 25-minute sets, like, with a team of 8 people, and you do, it's basically almost like a 3-act structure with different scenes, and in each act, each of those scenes are heightened. So it's like a little show that you all improvise together, and it has a beginning, middle, of an end, and end. So it took effort to learn this, but you know, it's nothing you have to write. It's nothing you really have to practice. You just have to show up. And then when you know this tool, you just do it with other people. And, it was a perfect fix at the time for, you know, feeling like an artist and a comedian.
Now, you say you don't have to, like, work at it and you don't have to practice it, but surely it must have been like something that you honed as a craft. Like, as you're doing it, you're getting better at it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's like going to the gym. If you have to work it out, you have practice, you know, you have to stay sharp. But other than that, you know, you don't have to come prepared.
So what is you said it was called Harold was the name of the format?
Yes, it's called Harold format. It's what they do at UCB, if anybody's familiar. They have UCB in New York and in Los Angeles, and they do it also at IO and I think some other places in Chicago. But those places are known for that Harold format, just because it's entertaining to watch because it has a structure, but there's no preparation other than practicing with your group. And yeah.
So how do you manage to put on a show? How do you manage to have a beginning, middle, and end that makes sense when you're all just making it up as you go?
You have to, that's where you have to stay. You have to stay sharp. You have to pay attention to what everybody is saying. You get a suggestion, and someone's suggestion could be, you know, mailbox. So the whole show, something's inspired by the mailbox. Maybe you're all in a postal workers, you know, at the post office. So you have three different scenes that are have something to do with something in a mailbox, post office, someone who got a package they wanted, different things in that world. And then every act, it's heightened. And then at the very end, ideally, everything is supposed to meld together.
Is it frightening to go out on stage not knowing, like, without a script?
It is frightening, but it's less frightening when everybody is doing it together. You know, when everybody is just as unprepared, you feel a collective sense of having each other's back.
Oh, you're in an ensemble comedy all of a sudden.
Exactly.
So, was there work that you're particularly proud of that you did there?
Not necessarily there. I ended up moving on to Second City, which, if anybody is familiar, they've been all over America. They tour. They're known for starting out in Chicago, which is where they're the most prominent. But they have one here in Hollywood as well, which is where I went. And there is where I actually learned how to write. So their whole thing is improv used as a tool to write sketches.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I learned how to write all my sketch comedy, because we improvised, and then we did sketches, and then we put them up on stage and created shows that way. And like Amy Poehler, Tina Fey, Rachel Dratch, all of these SNL people, especially from like the 90s and 2000s, even like A.D. Bryant, people that are on the show now, they all went to Second City and learned this exact same format. So a lot of people that became successful in sketch comedy, this is where they learned those tools. And that's where I learned them too.
So this sounds much more collaborative than just sitting down in a dark room and putting pen to paper. Were you writing sketch mm-hmm. comedy with friends and coworkers?
Yeah, there. I mean, you improvise together. You're on a team. You have a director. You improvise together, and then the director and everybody sees what we improvise and sees if there's any, if anything has legs. You know, if we can create a sketch out of something that has like three beats. Every sketch is supposed to have three beats because it's the same as Harold. Everything is in threes. Everything has to get heightened. So in a sketch, no matter how long or short it is, if it's going to be like a stereotypical successful sketch, it has to be heightened at least three times in order for people to get to know that what's funny about it.
And when you say heightened, yeah. Do you mean like the stakes are raised or something new is added?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Like, I'm trying to think of one that I even did. Like, if anybody looks at any of my videos, there's sections to them. There's a beginning, middle, and an end. And in the beginning, it's something maybe low stakes. And at the last beat, it's in the similar vein, but then we're talking about rimming or something, you know? Like, to me, you always have to heighten the stakes. I did one video where it was, do straight guys like to gossip? And initially we're talking about, oh, he thinks he's this size. Oh, he thinks he's that. Oh, he's lying. And then what else does he lie about? Oh, he says he's hooked up with this person. I've never even seen him have sex with anybody. I was like, oh my God, really? What else? So we're heightening where it's the next thing. And he's like, I heard that he wears a toupee. And I was like, oh my God, he wears a toupee. And then the guy comes in and I was like, oh, hey, what's going on? And then he's like, and then the guy that we were talking about, he's like, I blew this other guy, and he has a micro penis. So, okay, that's the most that you can heighten in this situation right now. So that's why I feel like my videos are entertaining, because I'm using the same format that I used at Second City for a stage sketch condensed into a YouTube video.
So you're putting the emphasis on the and in yes and.
100%. Yeah. It's all everybody's. But there also has to be conflict. There's no comedy without conflict. So, yeah.
You know, I think John Cleese said that his comedy, at least not all comedy, is a temporary anesthesia of the heart where something terrible is happening. But for some reason, it doesn't hurt to watch the terrible thing happening.
I completely agree with that. I mean, if anybody's watching any of my dumpster videos with my two buddies. If you look at it, we're just arguing. Mm-hmm. We're kind of arguing. There's conflict all the time. It's like, you don't have your summer body yet? What do you mean you don't have your summer body? We gave you all this time to get it ready, blah, 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 blah. We're arguing with each other, but we're on each other's side at the same time, you know? So it's the same thing. You could tell these are three best friends, but they're arguing.
So what came after, you said you went to these classes and then you went to, was it Second City that you went to or?
I got the scholarship at Iowa West. I did all that. And then I went to the Second City, which is where I learned how to, write and perform sketches. And then I also went to, UCB, which is pretty much just the same, learnings that they have at IO. And then I went to Groundlings, which is a completely different ball game. That's all. Short form improv and characters.
So you really had the sampler platter of improv schools.
Yes, I definitely for sure did.
What worked for you and what didn't?
What worked the most and what I gained the most out of was Second City. Honestly, that's where I learned pretty much everything that I still do today. I've never really been a loud comedian. I've never done really like physical comedy, and I feel like it's like at the Groundlings, they are very character driven, and that was a lot harder for me to tap into. So that was definitely a harder school for me to learn. I learned a lot there, but it was definitely a harder school for me as opposed to the other ones.
Tell me about the how the videos got started.
It started where getting cameras and professional level equipment and things like that became pretty accessible. So a lot of people were doing this. Maybe about 3 or 4 years ago, everybody had a Canon T2i, everybody had a boom, everybody had, you know, Final Cut or iMovie, and everybody knew how to just do it all. So I was like, you know what? I would be a moron to not be participating in this. So it's like, everybody put me in your videos, and nobody put me in their videos. So I was like, okay, forget all of this. It took me about a year sulking that nobody was really putting me in their videos enough. That I was like, I could just do my own. You know, I know how to do this. I learned how to do this, so I'm gonna do it. And I will get people to help me and do it with me. And honestly, that's what I did. But it did take some time to make some videos to learn what worked and what didn't, and what people wanted to watch and what they didn't, and what gay blogs cared about writing about and what they didn't. So, yeah, it was a learning curve, but, you know, I did get eventually get my groove.
Were you working with people that you'd met through the improv classes?
Yes, through Second City, I met someone that I made videos with in the beginning. And then I eventually found a different friend through UCB who primarily just liked the behind the scenes and directing and stuff to work on videos with. And he's somebody I work on my videos with now. And he's my friend Paul. He's in a lot of the videos too. And we're actually shooting a video tomorrow together. So, you know, we're heightening is what comedy is all about. And now we just keep heightening what we're doing. I mean, we made a pilot last year. We're working on a short film in a little bit. So these sketches are my bread and butter and something I absolutely love and enjoy doing. But now I'm thinking of my life in the comedy world, educational standpoint, and how can I heighten myself and what I'm doing next.
Well, that's great. It sounds like not only is this a recipe for comedy, but it's also good life advice.
Of course it is. I mean, comedy is all, at least improv is all about yes and. It's all about yesing. Once you say no, you kill a scene. You kill it. There's nothing anybody can go from once you say no. So that's the same with life, honestly, you know. Someone says no, it's like, okay, that's that roadblock. I guess I have to find another road, you know? And that's the same thing too, you know? And something that Tina Fey, something I learned from her, she came from I learned all the same things that she's learned at these schools because she went to the same ones. She's like, I live by the yes and, you know? Take every opportunity, take every path and every single thing that is offered to you, say yes to it, and then figure it out once you're there, you know. That's the same thing as being on an improv show and doing that Harold format. You don't know what you're doing, but you just say yes to it all, and you end up finding your way.
Were there opportunities that started coming to you from the videos?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've gotten a lot of opportunities. I've gotten opportunities. I've gotten, you know, sponsorships. I've gotten respect from people. I mean, I've gotten emails from people saying that they had to put down their dog, and the only thing that was making them happy that day was watching my videos. I've had people say during Hurricane Maria that they were watching my videos before their until their battery died, because they all wanted to, you know, laugh and have a good time until they got electricity again. I mean, that stuff is, you can't get better than that, honestly. That's all I've ever wanted.
That really seems to indicate, like, if somebody is in a hurricane and they're watching each other battery die, like, clearly they're getting some sort of sustenance that they needed from the comedy, media that you're giving them.
Comedy, you know, I'm not just giving people comedy. I'm giving people what the Golden Girls and Designing Women gave to me. You know, I'm giving them a personality, a face, and a perspective that is similar to them. People have told me that they see me in my videos and they're like, I've been you. I've gone through that same scenario. I've had that same thought process. And it's great to see you navigate it. It's great to see you have a lightheartedness or a funny way about going about things. You know, people relate to what I'm doing and the way that I am. And that's what I did with the Golden Girls and Designing Women. And I can't wait to do exactly what I'm doing now, you know, on a even bigger, huger level.
You said at the start of our conversation that you wanted, basically, you wanted to be seen, and you wanted to be an actor and be successful and to have an audience, and also to be taken seriously. And from the sound of it, like, there just came a point where you realized, like, oh, like, I can achieve my goals. Even, you know, I can feel more fulfilled about the work that I'm doing if I'm not taken entirely seriously.
Exactly. I mean, I'm taken seriously by not being serious, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever being taken seriously, I thought that it meant, I have respect. People respect me in the art and the medium that I'm participating in. And that's an amazing feeling, which is what I felt that I always wanted. That's what I wanted when I was in college, that I felt like I didn't get. And now I feel like I'm getting levels of that. So that's validating.
What would that college kid that you were think of the work that you're doing now?
Oh my goodness. I feel like I'm in therapy. Thank you.
No charge.
Sweet. You know, that college kid would probably be like, thank God you're getting it done. Thank God you're getting, you know, you're doing what you wanted to be doing, you know. Literally everybody I went to college with that was amazing in that program isn't doing it anymore. I'm the only one that's still participating in this medium. You know, I just had I'm happy I had the smarts to, you know, navigate myself into a different avenue, but in the same realm.
Yeah, it sounds like you'd be pretty proud of you.
Oh, for sure.
So where can people find your work? Where can they check out the videos?
If you just search Michael Henry on YouTube, I'm the first person to pop up. So, you know, that's an easy way to do it. But if you want the URL, it's youtube.com/Michael Henry Comedy. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Michael Henry 915, which is my birthday, which is in 2 days.
Happy almost your birthday.
Thank you so much. So yeah, those are the places you can find me, or you can find me wandering around Thai Town, which is the town I live in Hollywood.
Fantastic. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Michael for joining me. You can check out his videos on YouTube, which is my recommendation this week. They're all super short, and yet I keep finding myself spending way too much time clicking through one after another after the next. In particular, take a look for his video with a startling title, This Video is About HIV. As advertised, the video is about HIV. It's under 2 minutes, but in that time, we see a lightning-fast montage of gay men talking about or avoiding conversations about sex and health. Not only is it funny with a solid punchline on average every 3 seconds, but it is actually one of the most educational and honest lessons on HIV I've seen in a long time, covering topics like testing and PrEP and stigma. What I love about the video is that it jumps through every conversation queer guys need to have about AIDS and feel weird about bringing up, but hopefully a little less weird after this video deflates the somber attitude around STIs. But that's not all. There's also a great video about why men call each other masculine nicknames, another about the privilege of being pretty, one about how straight guys talk to gay guys about whether other men are attractive, and another about deciding whether or not to be a sex object. They're all short and pithy, and refer directly to some aspect of queer culture that it is about time someone brought up. As you watch, you may feel about 50% vindicated and 50% called out, which is about the right balance for any great work of art or YouTube video. Thanks to everyone who's rated and reviewed The Sewers of Paris. Thanks to all the listeners who keep the show going. There's rewards for backers. Head over to sewersofparis.com and click support the show on Patreon to join the folks who make the show possible. You can also check out sewersofparis.com to see links to some of the stuff we talked about on each episode, and I hope you'll join us for the next Sewers of Paris live chat with drag queen Arsa Nikki. That's on Saturday, October 27th at 2 p.m. Pacific. Let me know your thoughts via Sewers of Paris on Twitter and Facebook, or sewerspodcast@gmail.com. Check out the podcast Queens of Adventure to hear me lead a troop of drag queens on an epic Dungeons & Dragons adventure. That's at queensofadventure.com, where you can also get on the mailing list for upcoming live shows. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incomptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.